Okay, well, it's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to remember Partha. He and I started working together in 2004 at an organization that was being formed then called now the Lena Research Foundation. The task that was presented to us was to help an emerging company, which became a nonprofit foundation, to develop a way that an all-day recorder could be used in homes of children and an automated recognition of the material in those recordings could be utilized to some practical effect. The person who started this organization, Terry Paul, envisioned at the time that we would do automatic speech recognition of the these recordings and that we would tell what sounds the children were producing and what meanings they entailed. So we advised him that that was an awfully lofty goal that we might be wise to pare it down. We persuaded him to instead develop a team of people who would, first of all, develop that all-day recorder, which was not a trivial task in itself, but second, to develop a way to just recognize who was speaking, whether it was a female adult, a male adult, the child wearing the recorder, somebody else in the room, or other kinds of sounds that might be occurring in the room, just a labeling of those recordings. And after that point, we thought, if you can do that, then we can start building some additional elements into it. And ultimately, of course, we didn't think that this idea of automatic speech recognition was totally unrealistic, just that it was out of reach, at least in the short run. So, we began on this task with them. Let me quickly acknowledge that my work is supported currently by an NIDCD grant, and that Terry and Judy Paul are the founders of the Lena Research Foundation, and their efforts in this particular realm, financially speaking, have made it all possible in a lot of ways. And I'm also supported by the Plough Foundation that supports my chair of excellence at the University of Memphis. The collaborators in this particular project that I'm going to talk about today are listed here in rough order of their role with me. I met Partha on the very first day that I went to Boulder, where this foundation is located. We met at the airport and took a limousine together, and so he was the very first person associated with it that I had a chance to talk with. And it was, in my opinion, a really fortuitous circumstance because I felt incredibly engaged immediately. Partha was an awfully easy man to communicate with, and I enjoyed for every minute that I ever had with him being able to do that. So anyway, a little just concrete background now on this automated analysis approach and the recorder. You see a little picture here of the Lena recorder. It's just a little, iPod-sized device that is entirely battery-powered and can record for 16 hours. So it's an all-day recorder. And it is accompanied by, with the software that you connect to after the recording is done, an automated labeling algorithm for the waveforms, which has a whole background of its own, of course, which we can talk about a little. I'm not particularly expert in the methodology itself, but I can certainly describe it. Another thing that the Lena Research Foundation has done is they've gathered over 80,000 hours of recordings from children in their natural environments using this device. So it's provided a database that we can do remarkable things with, and there's a great deal going on beyond what I'm going to talk about this morning with that database and with accompanying bodies of recording that are being made all over the world by now. So acoustic analyses of infant and child vocalizations in these recordings is also possible, of course. Once you've identified who's speaking, you can select portions to analyze in special ways. And that's what we're actually going to be talking about primarily this morning. So an analysis that Partha and I worked on together with the group of people that were listed before is based on a vocal development theory that I've been working on since the 1970s. And that vocal development theory provides us with perspective on what kinds of acoustic parameters actually change across time. And they're not simple acoustic parameters. They're, in some cases, rather specific ones that are associated with aspects of the vocal system that we deem to be infrastructural with regard to the emergence of the speech capacity. And so the data that we're going to review here today are primarily those published in the PNAS article in 2010 that's cited here. You can find it easily enough by just typing in Aller PNAS or something, and you'll get the paper and its supplementary material. And I'll tell you a little bit about some of the things that have happened since that paper was published. Incidentally, it was published in July of 2010, so just 2 months before we lost him. So anyway, here's how this algorithm works. To start off with, you get the recording, and then the algorithm finds the child utterances. We're going to call them child utterance clusters because they're really groupings of things that kind of fit together in time, located by this automatic method. So just roughly, so you can see what things look like, if we have a waveform like this and a label like this, then this would be a child utterance cluster. A sequence of events that all fit together in time, and then we have a silence of 900 milliseconds, and then another child utterance cluster, and then a sequence of events that is actually associated with another speaker. So the female adult is speaking there, and then another child utterance cluster, and in the next slide we'll zoom in on the first of those child utterance clusters located by this automatic method. So just roughly, so you can see what things look like, if we have a waveform like this, and a label like this, then this would be a child utterance cluster, a sequence of events that all fit together in time, and then we have a silence of 900 milliseconds, and then another child utterance cluster, and then a sequence of events that is actually associated with another speaker. So the female adult is speaking there, and then another child utterance cluster, and in the next slide we'll zoom in on the first of those child utterance clusters, and you'll see that it actually has components within it as well. And the first one is the really interesting one because it is actually one of these speech-related child utterances. It's not cry, as the last one is, or a vegetative sound, as the middle one is. But it's actually something that sounds speech-like, and it's broken up into syllables. So this is the first syllable, and this is the second syllable, and that's the material we're interested in. And the analysis we're going to perform is going to be focused on those individual syllables. We'll keep track of how many utterances they occur in, how many of those child utterances they occur in, but we're interested in the syllables themselves for this analysis. And here's how the analysis actually works by the time we get to there, and it's the one that is based, as I said, on this theory of vocal development. So we're looking at 12 event types, and it's a very simple kind of an approach. First of all, we ask whether or not that syllable was voiced, that is to say, does an automatic pitch detection algorithm for more than 50% of the time period during which the syllable occurred detect a pitch? It's a simple kind of way of operationalizing this notion of whether or not there's periodic vocalization or phonation occurring during the vocalization. The second one is a more subtle and more difficult one to program, but what it does is to seek what we call canonical syllable transitions. A canonical syllable transition is a movement of the formants, the first and second formants primarily, from the onset of that syllable to some designated point where things stabilize, so to speak, in resonance. And if that transition occurs within 120 milliseconds, that fast, it's deemed to be a canonical transition, and then the syllable will deem to be a canonical syllable. The third parameter in this first group, which we call rhythm and syllabicity, is strangely related to it, but it turns out that it does fit together in principal components analysis. It's a spectral entropy factor, which evaluates the whole entropy of the spectrum across the period of the syllable and asks the question to what extent that energy is random and noisy. But it asks it in a rather special way for reasons that are too hard to explain here now, but I'll try to go into them later with anyone who would want to hear it. What it's really doing is looking for a spectral entropy range that is typical of the kind of entropy that occurs in real speech, because we don't speak in fully periodic voiced segments when we talk. We vary between high and low entropy in a particular range. The second group of parameters, of these 12 parameters, are associated with high pitch control and spectral tilt. The first one we just call squeal. And by that we mean that the vocalization has a very high pitch. It's got to be over 600 hertz in the mean. The second one is a low tilt of the spectrum parameter, and the high frequency one is related to it. In both cases, they're looking for relatively high energies at the in the high end of the spectrum as opposed to the kinds of energies you see in the low end when you have perfectly normal phonation in the kinds of range that we normally speak in. So this is the squeal group, so to speak, or the low spectral tilt group. And then there's a group that's associated with low pitch or growling. These are terms that are drawn from this literature in infant vocal development, where children do develop early in life vocalizations that that include these kinds of properties. They squeal, they growl, they do sounds in between, and it's clear that they're, in fact, producing these in a way that is purposefully contrastive. So we look for the child's control over the ability to do that kind of thing. So growling is one of the issues, and if the syllable is under 250 hertz in pitch across that time period, then we deem it a growl. And associated with the growl characteristic, there's a tendency for the first two formants to have wide bandwidths. And so that's the eighth parameter. And the last four are just about duration. So for these vocal islands or syllables, we ask the question, to what extent in four possible ranges do they, or whether they fit into each one of four possible ranges. And those ranges are associated with the durations of speech. So medium means this is the kind of duration that you typically find for a monosyllable pronounced in isolation in natural language. So if we give somebody a list of monosyllables to pronounce, they will tend to be produced with durations in between 250 and 600 milliseconds. A short syllable tends to be between 110 and 250. Long ones over 600. As a matter of fact, they're very rare in real speech, but they do occur. Extra long over 900 milliseconds. So that's what we're actually looking for in this effort. And I'll not go through further discussion of what's over here. You can read it in the paper if you're interested. Now, after having developed this scheme for doing analysis of the vocalizations in 2004 and 2005. I made the specifications of these kinds of parameters to engineers who were working for the foundation, and they implemented them then. In the meantime, they were developing the recorder, and they started acquiring recordings. And so we didn't change this descriptive system, this algorithm for analyzing the vocalizations at all from that point. Actually, we're starting to do it now, but through the point of the publication of the article, we didn't change it at all. So what we have is a set of completely independently prepared parameters and the way to analyze them with regard to these syllables that were based on vocal development theory. What we did then was we started trying to encourage the Lena Research Foundation to acquire recordings of children, not just who were developing typically. They were already doing that. They were developing a great sample from hundreds of kids from 2 to 48 months of age, very carefully stratified in terms of how they were sampled for socioeconomic status and such, all in the Denver area, but very nicely stratified. We started encouraging them to get samples on autistic children as well. And the very first time that I spoke with Partha, of course, we you know, sort of introduced ourselves in personal ways. I have an autistic grandson, I'm sure all of you know his connection with the world of autism as well. Both of us are very interested in that, for both personal and professional reasons. So anyway, we talked them into developing a body of data on children with autism, and they did it. So here's a kind of perspective on the actual sample that we ran this analysis on, and it's carefully selected from within the 80,000 hours of recording to make sure that all of the recording was done with exactly the same version of the recorder, and there are good reasons for having done it that way. In any case, there were 106 typically developing kids between 10 and 48 months. There were 77 autistic children between 16 and 48. And then there were a group of children with language delay, but that were not autistic. There were 49 of them, and they were between 10 and 44 months. There were multiple recordings on each child. So all in all, we had 1,486 recordings, 23,000 plus hours of recording, and over 3 million machine-identified child utterances were analyzed in the effort. The kids, of course, were actually rather different in terms of certain kinds of characteristics, and here's a quick view of that. In autism, you see about a 4 or 5 to 1 ratio boys to girls. And in the typical sample, of course, it's more even. And of course, what we tended to find was that the developmental age, and this is a nonverbal developmental age, tended to be higher in the typically developing kids, even if their real ages were fairly close, although as it turns out, the autism sample was older as well. In any case, with these kinds of differences, statistically significant differences in every case across this, we deemed it worthwhile to acquire a subset or to develop a subset of these three groups that was matched on the first three of those parameters, and so we did that. Okay, so this is a subset of 39 typically developing, 39 language delayed, and 35 autistic children that are matched well on gender, developmental age, and the mother's educational level, which is taken to be the best indicator of socioeconomic status. I'm not going to say anything more about that matched sample. I'll just tell you that all the results are the same, whether we use the sample as a whole or the matched sample. Nothing substantive changes. Okay, some basic quantitative results from this analysis. So remember now what we've done is we've taken the samples from all three groups of children. We've evaluated each syllable in terms of how it did or did not meet the requirements of one of those 12 parameters. And when we're finished for each child, actually for each recording, we have a mean number of we have a number of vocalizations of syllables that met the criteria for each of those 12 parameters divided by the number of utterances. Right? So it's a sort of proportional amount of meeting of each of those criterions for each child. And this is just a little overview of this expressed in standard scores. So we convert everything to Z-scores. And the blue is going to represent the values for the typically developing kids. The reason they aren't all zero here, because we're just referring now the two other groups to the typically developing kids, is concerned with the fact that we did a part of this calculation. We established the means and standard deviations at the recording level, and then we converted the data to the child level, because each child had at least six recordings. But you can see that for example, on voicing, the autistic and language-delayed children showed a great deal less voicing than the typically developing kids did, more than a standard deviation less. Right? They showed a lot less canonical syllable usage. They showed a lot less of the spectral entropy that is typical of speech. They showed more squealing, we're not sure why, but less of this low spectral tilt phenomenon. Then some non-significant differences across the middle group of the parameters when we just compare them directly in this way. And then on the parameters associated with duration, they showed far fewer of the syllables that would have been in the sort of right in the middle range for speech, fewer in the short range, and many more in the extra long range, the kinds of syllables that would never occur in speech. So these give us just a sort of a panorama of a very, very noticeable differences between the groups in a just sort of a first quick look at how the groups differed with regard to these phenomena. But perhaps more interesting and important is how well can we predict age by utilizing these kinds of parameters. And let's start by looking at correlations of the 12 acoustic parameters with age. So within each group, there's a substantial age range, and so we can develop a correlation for how much of each of these things the child does that the children do as they get older, so to speak. So there's a very high correlation, almost 0.7, in the typically developing group between age and how much they meet the criterion of voicing. So as they get older, they're producing voicing better. The language delayed group similarly shows a very high correlation, and each of these little asterisks indicates whether or not this is a significant correlation. We're talking about wildly significant correlations. In fact, all of the correlations for all of the parameters are statistically significant. Sometimes they're negative because the child does less of something across time, which makes sense in the case of squealing, and in case of this extra long parameter. But they're all statistically significant in the case of the typically developing group, and I'm talking about, as I said, wildly statistically significant. And they're almost all statistically significant in terms of the language delay group. But very few of them are statistically significant with regard to the autism group. So in simple interpretation, the typically developing kids are changing across time with regard to these parameters, and they're changing in ways that is predictable, in the main at least, with respect to this theoretical perspective that established or that suggested we use these parameters in the first place. But the group of autistic children were changing relatively little with regard to the same parameters across time. Okay, now age prediction in another way. Let's do this by multiple linear regression now. And each blue dot represents a recording from a typically developing child across the age range that we had, 10 to 48 months. And what we've done is we've modeled, using the 12 parameters, a predicted vocal development age, or let's just call it predicted age, on the base, and then plotted it against the real age of the child. And the correlation here at the recording level is 0.76, I think. And if you do it at the child level, it's over 0.8. So the model actually is quite powerful in terms of predicting where a what a child's status is, completely independently of anything subjective. This is a 100% objective analysis. And again, established before we even had any data to look at. And no changes have been made since. So I often point out to people that, I mean, I don't know whether it's true and I've never tested it, but my guess is this, that this correlation is about as high as you could hope to get in any kind of a developmental circumstance, because you have to have variation, right, across kids and how they're doing. I mean, no one expects all kids at the same age to do just the same. I suspect you wouldn't get a higher correlation with age if you tried to predict it by measuring the child's height. So this is a very powerful tool, it turns out, and it surprised us very, very substantially. I mean, we were surprised when we first saw the differences between the groups as well. But this was actually the first thing we saw, was this correlation with age. And I was stunned. It's really quite remarkable that just looking at the vocalizations in terms of these parameters that were selected at my desk, that we could get this level of correlation across time. Now, we're going to plot on the same page based on the regression model that was developed on these 106 typically developing kids. We're going to plot now the recordings for the autistic children, and here they are. Again, there's a lot of spread, as you might expect, but very notably, the group of the recordings from the autism group falls typically below in predicted vocal development level that of the typically developing kids. And the correlation across time is much lower. In fact, it's not very far from zero. So we can say on the basis of this outcome that the typically developing children change in a predictable way across time with regard to these vocal parameters, and that the group of autistic children does not change in the same way across time. It's not true that they don't change across time, because if you model them directly, you get a higher correlation, not nearly as high as for the typically developing group, but you get a good bit higher than the one that you see here. But we applied the model of the typically developing kids here, and what we find is that they're not changing across time in the same way that the typically developing kids are. And in the next picture, what you'll see is big diamonds that represent the individual 77 typically autistic children, just to give you a kind of scope of how they look as individual children with regard to the regression line in blue of the typically developing group. So I Partha and I saw this graph immediately, as soon as the data were in and we decided we'd run a multiple regression on it, and we said, well, we're going to write a paper. this deserves a paper. But Partha immediately pointed out that this is actually not the most important analysis for us to do, if what we're trying to do is to tell how well this kind of a procedure might, in an automated setting entirely with no human intervention, be able to differentiate between the groups. And of course, he suggested that we use a discriminant analysis or a logistic regression or something to do that. Notice that it looks like, according to this graph, that as time passes, the groups are separating more, right? And it might suggest that if you utilize this kind of procedure, you wouldn't do very well at differentiating the groups at the youngest stages, right? Okay, so, but remember that this is a linear regression, and it wasn't designed to model the discrepancy between the groups. It was designed to model the change in age for the typically developing group. All right, so we go on now to a discriminant analysis, which is going to quantify the potential for an automated approach of this sort to detect anomalies in development. And here's the product of a discriminant analysis with just the autism and typically developing group displayed in what we call a bubble plot. probably many of you have seen bubble plots before, though I particularly like them in this setting. The way it works is that after the discriminant analysis, you have an estimated posterior probability of autism for each child. And that estimated posterior probability for 26 of the 77 autistic children was nearly 1. And the estimated probability for 27 of the typically developing kids was nearly 0. And you can see what happened across all of the other kids in the middle with varying sizes of bubbles representing varying numbers of children. And if we were to split, say right about here, just take arbitrarily that kind of criterion for the way we would set up our diagnostic procedure, we could estimate that we would have very few false positives in our screening for autism, and we would catch most of the kids with autism using this entirely automated and objective procedure. And if we utilize the equal error probability or the equal correctness probability, we find that the procedure is a sort of 86% correct for these two samples on both sides. 86% of the typically developing kids are correctly identified as typically developing, and 86% of the autistic children correctly identified as autistic. Okay, one last slide, because I know I'm running out of time here. And just to show you the robustness of this procedure, because as I say, we were really stunned at the first round of results from this. None of us expected very much of this kind of automated approach, because automatic speech recognition is still in a sort of infancy in the view of most of us who are associated with this enterprise. And we didn't think that by working with such complicated things as naturalistic recordings from kids that you'd be able to do much of anything. But in fact, it's very robust. It predicts age very well, and it predicts differences in groups at a level, I'm not sure whether that 86% correct means a lot to you. In that age range, that approaches the level of the best diagnostic procedures. It's not real clear exactly how to make the comparison, because how we've done this and how people go about testing the reliability of the best of diagnostic procedures is very different. But it's clear it's not far off. For example, if you take a group of autistic children who have been diagnosed with the so-called ADOS, the Autism Diagnostic Observation Schedule, which is the sort of gold standard, and you look at them under 3 years of age and then follow them until they're 7, about 30% of those children who were diagnosed with autism before age 3 will end up losing the diagnosis by age 7. So it may be that this kind of procedure is going to work just about as well as anything that is available currently. And of course, we're using the ADOS and other things like it as our gold standard. What we're saying when we say we've done 86% correct identification is we're referencing the diagnoses that were given to us about those children. So anyway, there are some other questions about how robust the procedure is. Does it apply across boys and girls? Does it apply across different socioeconomic status? Is it so simple that all the procedure is doing is to find the kids who can't talk? And it recognizes the difference between kids who talk and kids who don't. Since autistic kids don't talk so much, maybe it's just differentiating them because the autistic kids don't talk very much. Okay, those are the kinds of questions that were posed to us by the reviewers at BNAS. And so this graph gives you some answers to those questions. So for the whole sample, this is what the picture looks like with a 95% confidence interval on the autism group, shown here around a mean posterior probability of autism that is something like 0.87, okay, and a mean for the typically developing group that was under 0.1, so 0.06 or something like that, and the 95% confidence interval around that. So we've got huge group differences. Then we split them into the boys and the girls. The girls are a smaller group, but there were some girls, so we compare the typically developing girls against the autistic girls, and the difference is pretty much the same kind of picture. We break them by high socioeconomic status and low socioeconomic status based on the mother's educational level, and again, the differences are substantially the same. We use something called the snapshot language score, which includes a lot of stuff that has to do with gesture as well as speech. So we don't get as strong a difference under those circumstances, but we presume it's because it's confounded with all of the stuff that's associated with gesture. But here's the really interesting one. We happen to have a measure of the number of expressive words in the child's vocabularies, for both groups. Not for every single child, but we had it for enough of them that we were able to match a subset of, I think it was 35 children in each group, where they had exactly the same scores. Okay, so remember the question, could it be that this is just finding the autistic kids who can't talk? Okay, now we're going to compare autistic kids who talk just the same amount as typically developing kids, and this is the difference that we get. Whoops, this one, okay? So we still get a massive difference between the groups, even in that case. So what this tells us is that what the automated analysis is doing is it's isolating something about vocalization itself, something about the style and way in which vocalization is being implemented. We went through quite an elaborate effort to try to figure out how best to portray what it was about those 12 parameters that was creating this differentiation. And the best that we can come up with at this time, because it's just 12 parameters and we could have tried 10 million, right? The best we came up with was that that it appeared to be the case that the autistic children were showing less well-formed syllabification across time. So that first group of parameters, add to it the medium duration one. That first group of parameters was accounting for almost all of this differentiation. The children were being differentiated by the extent to which their vocalizations could be deemed to be speech-like. Even if they were talking, they weren't necessarily talking in a way where the vocalizations met all the criteria for canonical syllabification. And I think I'll stop there. Thank you. Oh, quickly, just one last thing. Remember the discriminant analysis and the age question? So here's the plot when you simply plot the posterior probabilities for the autism sample and the typically developing sample across age. And here it does not look at all like there's any kind of limitation on this kind of method depending on the age of the child. We were doing just as well at the lower ages and discriminating them as at the upper ages. So there we go.
So some questions? We have some